How political values and social influence drive polarization. This week on The Science of Politics. For the Niskanen Center, I'm Matt Grossman. Americans are increasingly polarized, with more aligned partisanship, identities, and ideology, suggesting that differences over deeply held values may drive us apart. But we may instead be repeating what we hear in our cloistered social networks and information environments, following friends and leaders more than our inner values. Or some people may be more likely to trust their values, while others want to conform to group norms. Today, I talked to Bob Lupton of the University of Connecticut about his British Journal of Political Science article with Stephen Smallpage and Adam Enders, Values and Political Predispositions in the Age of Polarization. He finds that partisanship and ideological self-identification have become increasingly tightly associated through values like social traditionalism and egalitarianism, but only among those with conservative values, due to distinct messages from each side's elites. I also talked to Elizabeth Chase Connors of the University of South Carolina about her political behavior article, The Social Dimension of Political Values. She finds that people with more ideologically aligned social networks are more likely to link their values in partisanship, as networks enforce conformity, and people who monitor how others see them can be convinced to endorse values when they hear them from political elites. They agree that our values and social relationships increasingly go together, limiting conflicts between partisanship, views, and identities. Lupton finds core values help align views with partisanship, at least among conservatives.
Our goal in the article was to examine the role of core values in the process of sorting citizens' ideology and partisanship. A good deal of American politics scholarship shows that individuals' ideological self-identifications are more closely connected to their party affiliation, meaning self-identified liberals are more likely to call themselves Democrats, and self-identified conservatives are more likely to call themselves Republicans now relative to the past. And we want to know if core values, citizens' fundamental principles that define what is good and bad in the world, influence the sorting process that has brought individuals' ideological identities to their natural partisan homes. And our key finding was that the alignment or the sorting of ideological and partisan identities since 1988 has been driven largely by individuals who possess conservative core values, specifically toward egalitarianism and moral traditionalism.
He says core values should be durable public views.
Values generally are important to the political realm because they transcend specific situations, and thus they're more stable than ordinary political attitudes or opinions, which for many or most people are transient. And so, for example, someone's core value orientations, what we call them, should be more durable than the person's attitude toward, for example, whether government spending should be increased or decreased, or what the level of defense spending should be, for example, or tax policy. And we examine egalitarianism and moral traditionalism specifically because evidence and experience show that these values are prominent in American political culture. Egalitarianism is measured as a 6-item scale, capturing the extent to which the individual believes that social, economic, and political equality is a problem in need of government redress, or if inequality is a natural and perhaps even preferred societal state. So the egalitarian scale includes questions such as, our society should do whatever is necessary to make sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed, and if people were treated more equally in this country, we'd have many fewer problems. So they're agree-disagree format. And moral traditionalism captures the culture war division between individuals who are tolerant of different lifestyles and moral codes, and those who believe that newer lifestyles are contributing to moral decay and that traditional family arrangements foster a healthier society. Questions in this 4-item scale, also in agree-to-disagree format, include statements such as, the world is always changing, and we should adjust our view of moral behavior to these changes. And decades of research demonstrates that these two values are important for understanding individuals' subsequent political attitudes, attachments, and behavior. We show that value orientations exist on a continuum ranging from egalitarian and morally progressive to anti-egalitarian and morally traditional.
But Connors wanted to challenge the notion that political values are our grounding.
Political scientists for decades have worried about the ability of everyday citizens to make rational political choices, given low political knowledge, and then findings that people shift their attitudes seemingly randomly or in response to framing effects. So among the saviors of these of the everyday citizen was these political values. So political scientists believed that, yes, people are not entirely knowledgeable, somewhat easily persuadable by the elites, by the media, and their social context, but political values can ground them. If people believe in equality, for example, they can use that value to guide them to make sound political choices. So what I find doesn't fit with that rosy picture. Instead, I find that political values can't be these guideposts because they themselves are guided by or are a function of social contexts. So Democrats say they value equality because that's what Democrats are supposed to value. And Republicans say they value moral traditionalism because that's what Republicans are supposed to value. And so my results suggest that political values are not these stable guideposts and that we can't rely on them to save or guide the everyday citizen.
And social networks could matter for the alignment of values and partisanship.
I argue that this occurs because people have an innate desire to impress others or to fit in, and that this desire plays out in politics, including in people's value expressions. So I find evidence of this in a few different ways. And first, I'll talk about the observational that you said, but then I'm going to quickly touch on some of the experimental stuff because I think it speaks to the sort of the question of why this occurs. So first, I not only find that people with more ideologically aligned social networks are more likely to link their values to their partisanship, but that this is true even of people sort of assigned social networks, meaning their work colleagues and their neighbors. So I'll give you an example to help explain this. So I find, for example, that a Democrat who has all Democratic neighbors and coworkers in their social network is more likely to endorse equality than is a Democrat who has Democratic and Republican neighbors and coworkers in their social network, all else being equal. So this gives me a bit more leverage to say that it's not people choosing their networks based on their these values and their partisanship, but that it is more of a social influence story of people adopting the values they think they're supposed to be adopting. But beyond the social network effects, I also use an individual level trait called self-monitoring to get at this mechanism or the why this occurs, why people are adopting their party's political values. So this trait is a measure of how willing people are to morph themselves into social contexts. So this means that people higher in the trait are more willing to succumb to social desirability or to social pressure. And what I find is that when I tell people that a socially desirable group endorses compromise, those higher in this trait are more likely to also endorse compromise. So together, these network and self-monitoring results suggest that it is this desire to impress others that is guiding people's adoption of political values.
Overall, as Lupton finds, Americans now have more aligned partisanship and ideology.
By sorting, it just means, again, that you know individuals who think of themselves as, for example, a conservative, right? When people are asked, you know, do you identify, do you think of yourself as liberal or conservative? And so someone who says, I'm a conservative, who attach that label to themselves, they're more likely to also call themselves a Republican, right? To identify with that political party and think of themselves as a Republican now more than the past. And so core values then are these enduring abstract principles that drive citizens' evaluations of the world and guide their behavior.
And polarization has helped this process along.
To your point, I think political elites are crucial to the story, because their communication strategies connect citizens' values, ideology, and partisanship. So more generally, as elites have become more polarized and adopted rhetoric accordingly, they've resonated with citizens' core values and rendered values cleavages more salient to political competition. And so in the article, as you know, we measured this elite polarization using DW nominate scores, showing that as congressional polarization, as measured by roll call votes, has increased, so too has this sorting. In future work, I would like to test experimentally directly how elite rhetoric connects to citizens' core values.
Conservative elites especially have helped lead the alignment.
Our theory was that individuals with conservative value orientations that is those who are anti-egalitarian and morally traditional, are driving the sorting process, so the alignment of ideological and partisan identifications. And our thinking was that because conservative political elites, elected officials, party activists, and the media use more ideological language than their liberal counterparts, this would help connect core value orientations to the appropriate ideological label and party attachment among the mass public. And so we thought that this process would mean that conservative value orientations would be the driver of this process. In other words, I think our results testify to the differing communication strategies among Democrats and liberals versus Republicans and conservatives.
And liberals may now be following.
One way to think about it is, I think in recent years, especially since the last year, even the WE exam, 2012, liberal identification has increased sharply among Democrats, perhaps due to Trump backlash on the Republican agenda. So I think updating this, I would expect to see a greater connection between Democratic partisanship and liberal ideology among liberal values holders now relative to the past. Although I still might expect to see a stronger connection among conservative values holders for the reasons I mentioned, it is true that it seems in recent election cycles, Democrats really seem to be endorsing the liberal label more. It explains a lot of, among whites at least, among people who have left the Democratic Party or who did, yeah, during this previous time.
Connor's experiment shows how elite standards can move voters through group norms.
The experimental setup was sort of a maneuver to deal with the fact that the world already knows that Democrats endorse equality and that Republicans endorse moral traditionalism, for example. So what I did was I took a value that could be political, but that people didn't necessarily associate with a party. And I pretested this, but I decided on compromise from these pretests. And compromise would be as opposed to standing your ground. So the value of compromise versus standing your ground. And then I also took a socially desirable group, or a group that people would want to associate with. I also pretested this and found that the most socially desirable group of the ones that I looked at was those that listened to news sources that support both political parties, which I thought was interesting on its own. But so I picked this group that would endorse the compromise end of this compromise versus standing your ground value. And what I did was I randomly assigned people to either be simply asked which they value more, compromise or standing your ground, or be asked this after they were told that the socially desirable group, those that listen to news sources that support both political parties, endorses compromise. And what I found is that when people were told that the socially desirable group endorses compromise, endorsement of compromise went up. And it went up even more so among those higher in self-monitoring, the trait that I mentioned earlier, suggesting that the mechanism behind this adoption of compromise is these self-presentation desires or the desire to impress others that I talked about. Now, of course, all political values aren't the same. So there may be some that are harder to move with a simple social cue because people have internalized these values more, even if they were originally adopted through the process that I'm talking about. They just might be more stable. And this could also differ by person and likely does differ by person. Some people may deeply believe in compromise or another political value, while others just don't have a strong feeling towards it, and they're thus more able to be swayed by the social cue.
And social influence can come from any group or elite norm.
So I think the main idea is that as long as you create sort of social norm within a group, it doesn't necessarily matter if the origin of the social pressure is from political elites. So, for example, political elites deciding that equality is the value of the Democratic Party, as long as that becomes like the norm within Democrats. So the social influence story could originate from political elites. It could originate from, like I said, people actually believe it, Democrats actually believing in equality. But it's exacerbated once this norm is created, once everyone knows sort of that Democrats endorse equality and Republicans endorse moral traditionalism. And thus, to be a good Democrat, you have to endorse equality. And to be a good Republican, you have to endorse moral traditionalism.
The people who are high in self-monitoring are the most likely to be influenced. Connors explains what that means.
Self-monitoring is simply, so everyone can perceive if something is socially desirable or not. Those that are higher in self-monitoring are those that are more willing to change themselves to fit that socially desirable norm. So, for example, it could be a social norm or a socially desirable norm to exercise regularly. And everyone could witness that this is the case, but high self-monitors are more willing to lie and say that they exercise more to fit that norm, whereas low self-monitors would say, yes, it's socially desirable, but I only exercise once a month and I'm willing to tell you that. The way that it's measured, this research on this trait goes back from Snyder in the 70s. And it was originally measured, I think, with like 24 questions. It went down to 18, I think. Now it's 3 questions. Adam Barinsky has looked into how to get the 3 best measures to create this construct. The questions are, when you are with other people, how often do you put on a show to impress or entertain them? And then when you are in a group of people, how often are you the center of attention? And then how good or poor of an actor would you be? And they give 5 different response options from, you know, good to bad. And so you put these 3 measures together and then create a construct called self-monitoring. That's a 13-point scale. In observational data, they certainly do pay more attention to everything. They vote more. They're more interested in politics. They watch news all the time. But given research that I've done and past research, I don't believe this to be the case. I'm actually, at some point in the future, it's kind of this project that keeps moving down the line, but I want to look at how to better validate these measures, because obviously there's so much social desirability within them. And just briefly, what I've found is that, yeah, the high self-monitors are basically lying about paying attention. They say they read news more, for example, but they don't have higher political knowledge. And for low self-monitors, reporting paying attention to news predicts political knowledge. But for high self-monitors, it doesn't, probably because they are lying about paying attention.
Polarization, she finds, increases social influences.
One outcome of polarization is basically that it makes social influence within parties easier. And this is both because social polarization and effective polarization. So imagine a world of less social polarization in which half of my friends are Republicans and half are Democrats. In this world, I'm getting social signals from both parties, right? Now imagine a world that we live in today in which all of my friends are Democrats. In the non-polarized world, social cues are constantly competing with each other, and so it's harder for me to see what is socially desirable. But in the polarized world, I get the same social cues over and over again from my Democratic friends. It's abundantly obvious what is socially desirable. And not only from my friends, but also my day-to-day life. In the polarized world that we live in today, people can even figure out who's a Democrat and who's a Republican by looking at, you know, the car they drive, for example. So I'm, again, getting more social signals about what Republicans and what Democrats do. Another part of this polarization story is the effective side. So Democrats liking Democrats more than Republicans and vice versa. This also can make signaling easier, because the more I like a group or the more I like a person, the more social influence they can have over me. So just like I explained in the experiment, a socially desirable group is able to guide people, especially high self-monitors. So when I like my fellow party members, that means they have more power. If I like them less, for example, in a world of no effective polarization, they wouldn't have this power. And as you've noted, there is research that shows people's political values have become more polarized during this time of partisan polarization. And I would argue that at least some of this value polarization is just the result of social influence and of polarization.
Lupton says there is reciprocal causation among partisanship and values, but core values still matter.
Core values such as egalitarianism, moral traditionalism, and predispositions such as ideological self-identification and party identification are indeed difficult to entangle, as you suggest. All these constructs are important for understanding citizens' approach to politics, and many accounts consider partisanship the fundamental lens through which citizens see the political world. Unraveling these interconnected concepts is made more difficult through data limitations, fortunately, but most panel data analyses that have investigated these relationships, including in my own work, show that core values shape party identification, especially more than the reverse over time. So I do not believe that one can deny that these relationships are in some sense reciprocal, but the bulk of the evidence, which I'm aware, supports theoretical accounts of values primacy in citizens' belief systems, that they are the bedrocks that more so than the reverse shape ideology and party identification.
And core values may help lead many other aspects of polarization.
This article is one component of my agenda, investigating the role of core values for understanding polarization of contemporary American politics. So, as you know, egalitarian and morally traditional postures, especially the former, were important to the Southern Republican realignment. And my most recent article shows that core value extremity promotes disdain for one's opposing party and its candidates and affiliated ideological group. More generally, I believe that values, despite a rich theoretical and empirical history in political science, are too often overlooked in current scholarly portraits of polarization. I find inescapable the role of egalitarianism and moral traditionalism in elite political rhetoric and in how ordinary citizens talk about politics. To me, this country is divided fairly obviously between those who believe that socio-political and economic equality plagues our society and those who feel that unequal resources are the uniquely American outcome of differences in talent, ingenuity, and effort. These fundamental differences extend to debates concerning redistributive tax policy, racial and gender equality, environmental justice, and more. Similarly, we disagree about tolerance for alternative lifestyles and modes of conduct, which now most squarely impinges on LGBTQ plus issues, but also still very much, for example, includes the abortion issue.
Polarization is about real differences in views, but not necessarily on policy specifics.
Values underlie many of the identities and political attitudes that are commonly viewed as drivers of political polarization. So a simple but a poignant quote in a recent Evans and Niendorf article is, quote, "It seems unlikely that people randomly attach themselves to parties." And so similarly, I find values important for aligning citizens' social and political identities, which I do not believe occurs spontaneously due to, for example, some empty form of tribalism. And so I don't think that core values render citizens more, quote, ideological per se than we usually believe, because I don't believe that values produce consistent political attitudes across domains, for example. They don't shape a far-flung or complex belief system. But I do think that citizens possess coherent value orientations that provide them with a clearer map of the political world than we often suggest. So in my early work, for example, I show that polarization's not produced any appreciable increase in ideological thinking among vast swaths of the electorate. Those increases have been confined instead to interested, involved, and knowledgeable citizens. But I do think that value orientations do promote more crystallized political thinking than we ordinarily consider, I think.
Values are also important in explaining group identity alignment.
I do not view core values as an alternative to narratives focused on racial, gender, religious influences, on political attitudes, attachments, and behavior. Instead, I view them as complementary. I believe that values, for example, are important for understanding identity alignment. Some of the best recent political scholarship, including pathbreaking work by Liliana Mason and others, highlights that polarization can be pernicious precisely because it aligns citizens' political identities with their racial, gender, and religious identities, for example. And the loss of cross-cutting attachments undermines empathy and the potential for political compromise. Much of my current work seeks to understand core values' role in the sorting of these identities or this identity alignment. In other words, I endeavor to see if there's a there to polarization. And I do think that values are important for understanding this identity alignment. And I should say, that questions of equality, especially in American politics, are racialized, although we still see a role for egalitarianism across many issues and attachment, even controlling for racial resentment, for example, or racial attitudes.
But Connors finds that social influence on group identity is also strong.
Identities matter insofar as people are identifying with something, they are potentially a part of that group. And they also then are more easily influenced by that group, both because they interact with them more often and because they want to appease them. So, for example, we'll just talk about partisanship since we have been. If you identify as a partisan, you are a part of that group and you likely surround yourself with other Democrats if you're a Democrat. And you also want to seem like a good Democrat to other Democrats. So the social influence story there is not necessarily how much you identify with a group, but as long as you're a part of that group and you want to appease them and you spend time with them, the social influence story should sort of be the same. So I look in the values piece that we're talking about, but also in a more recent polarization piece, I actually test if the treatments work differently, not just by self-monitoring, which is what I hypothesize to be important, but also by partisan strength, with the idea that potentially it's that the stronger these identities are to people, the more easily they are to be socially influenced by that group. But I don't find that to be the case. So it seems to be just that as long as you're a part of that group and you associate with that group, you can be socially influenced by them. And the variation is not dependent on how much you identify with them, but how much you're willing to change yourself to appease them.
Lupton says campaign contexts and discussions can matter for values, especially their expression.
I think the core values are socially constructed in that political rhetoric and competition help align citizens with certain value orientations on opposite sides of the political spectrum. Additionally, plenty of work, including Elizabeth's excellent political behavior article, shows that values are not totally immutable or immune from social context or campaign effects, for example. So indeed, even in my own work, in my own early work, co-authors and I show that discussion network disagreement can attenuate the connection between core values and partisanship, for example. So I definitely see that the social potential social influences on values.
But he says social influence doesn't undermine the influence of values.
I think it could be potentially for some people, right? So for these high self-monitors, people who are particularly conscientious or who are joiners, potentially. But I think the evidence is too strong over time regarding values influence on not only political attitudes, but again, fundamental predispositions such as partisanship and ideology, for values to be entirely just this process of individuals, you know, becoming egalitarians or morally traditionalists because they believe that these are the positions they're supposed to adopt. So I would say that's much too strong of a interpretation of those values.
And Connor says social influence could make the true values voters more important by spreading their messages.
There are very different people. There are some people that are going to hear that as a good Democrat, you're supposed to endorse equality, and so they'll do so. But there are also people that really believe in equality, and they might have picked the Democratic Party because of that. And those people are probably guiding the ones who are then adopting those values.
Both stories can be true because individuals vary.
I think that while values could certainly matter for some people in aligning political ideology and partisanship, as Bob finds, all of these constructs have some level of social influence within them. So for some people, potentially the politically interested or politically sophisticated or some other variable, this social influence could be negligible. So they could really care. They could be a Democrat, really care about equality, and align their ideology to all these things kind of work together because they care about these things. For others, especially high self-monitors, like I find, it could be the only thing tying these three constructs together, meaning a high self-monitor, for example, a high self-monitor Republican could only be a conservative who endorses moral traditionalism because they've received cues that this is what they're supposed to do as a Republican. It's the only thing tying these three constructs together. And actually, in their more recent piece that I think is building off the one that you were originally talking about in PSRM, they also find that value extremity predicts polarization. And I actually find in a more recent piece that I mentioned before that polarization, or at least effective polarization, is also guided by social context, just like values are. So again, I think a lot of these constructs can work together for some people just from a social influence story. And for other people, they could work together because they actually do care about these things and they have aligned their partisanship to the values that they really believe in. So they're just, there are different people in the world. Some are more likely to follow my story, and some are more likely to follow Bob's story.
Lupton says the Trump era has likely kept polarization on values growing.
I can only imagine that the Trump era rendered values more salient, given the sharp divisions that his administration evoked. So one value that's potentially more potent now relative to the pre-Trump era is authoritarianism, although I believe that links closely to egalitarianism. For example, folks are who are willing to eschew political norms to gain power and who believe in strict racial and political hierarchies are most certainly anti-egalitarian. And ultimately, to our earlier discussion of value alignment, I believe that the Trump administration only served to heighten the connection between core value orientations and subsequent political attachments, attitudes, and behaviors. So I think it would be a further polarization along these lines, fault lines.
And class de-alignment is not making egalitarianism any less important.
I think that that particular cleavage is only more salient now than in the past. Because, right, the Republican elite posture on that is the Democratic elites are trying to social engineer to tell people in the lower class, right, that they're not good enough and that somehow they need government assistance, but that really we just want government to leave us alone. And it also, right, implicitly also speaks to people's sort of fear of equality, right? So that people who are receiving this message can still say, well, I'm still above the below, right? Even if I'm below the upper. So I think that egalitarianism is only more relevant now than ever before as a division in the parties. And so, for example, one existing project about which I'm excited, an ongoing project, examines the role of egalitarianism specifically in the Democratic Party. So existing work shows that the Democrats are not as overtly ideological as Republicans, because the former is more a collection of organized interests than an ideological movement. So this scholarship channels the famous Will Rogers quip, right? I'm not a member of any organized political party, I'm a Democrat. However, our evidence suggests that egalitarianism is in fact arguably the central organizing principle of the contemporary Democratic Party. And so it is exactly these high-income, high-educated, sophisticated voters who do not stand necessarily to benefit from Democratic policy priorities that nonetheless endorse them on account of their egalitarian postures.
Connor says Trump showed that elite influence can change opinion through social norms.
Elite rhetoric can potentially create a social norm about what is desirable within that party. So, for example, Trump could create the norm that it's socially desirable to say that there was election fraud. I actually, in recent work, do find that to be the case, that Republicans believe it is socially desirable for them to say that there is election fraud, and Democrats say that it's the opposite, and that likely originated from Trump, right? That was likely an elite story, but an elite story that eventually became a social influence story. So I think all these things are tied together. I mean, elite rhetoric matters in as much that it can create a socially desirable norm within a party.
Lupton is pursuing a lot more to understand core values.
I'm eager, again, just to examine the role of value divisions in the Biden era. I think that the electorate's only become more divided over these central core values. I think it shapes policy debates. And I'm also interested in the comparison of value profiles among party activists. So those individuals who attend the Democratic and Republican National Party conventions and the mass public. And I'm also engaged in current work with Adam Enders, examining how consistent value orientations promote what we call political constraint or crystallized political thinking. And so people who are consistent in their posture toward egalitarianism and moral traditionalism demonstrate higher levels of ideological constraint relative to other citizens. And they also are more likely to place the parties and candidates correctly in ideological space. And they have stronger affective orientations toward the parties, candidates, and ideological groups. And these results hold even after controlling for factors such as education, income, political interest, and knowledge. And so that's one thing that I'm continually interested in exploring, is how value consistently promotes a type of political sophistication independent of traditional predictors of complex thinking. right? Because I think core value orientations, again, provide people with a clear map of the political world.
And Connors is doing a lot more work on social influence, including where it might be a positive.
Where I'm going from here is a lot of work tied to what we've been discussing, the polarization piece that I was talking about, basically a lot of work looking at partisan social pressure or the desire to fit in with your partisan group can influence reports of polarization or belief in election fraud or attitudes and values, etc. But I'm also trying to sort of balance this out, still staying in my line of research on social influence. And instead of looking at what I've been finding thus far, which is somewhat depressing results or depressing implications from my results, I'm trying to look at how social interactions and social context and social cues can actually be helpful to normative democracy rather than contributing to polarization or overreporting polarization. So actually one piece that I'm really excited about, and it's not necessarily tied to the 2020 election or Biden, et cetera, but it's about social interactions with people and how these social interactions can potentially save us from the world that we've been living in the recent years. So I look at how, in one piece, I look at how tone can matter and how people disagree, and that people expect politics to be heated and they don't like that, or most people don't like that, understandably. And so what they do is they turn off from engaging in political discussions with people with which they might disagree. And we know that these interactions are kind of normatively beneficial. And so people disengaging from them is a problem for the reasons that we know, and then also for reasons like creating even worse effective polarization and social polarization, just like separating the world into Republicans versus Democrats. And so I kind of am trying to move towards normatively helpful research that could maybe give us recommendations about how we should be interacting with each other and how we can make the world a better place. Maybe a place where Republicans don't feel social pressure to say that they endorse election fraud, or a place where partisans don't feel pressure to say that they hate the other party and like their own.
There's a lot more to learn. The Science of Politics is available biweekly from the Niskanen Center and part of the Democracy Group Network. I'm your host, Matt Grossman. Thanks to Bob Lupton and Elizabeth Chase Connors for joining me. Please check out Values and Political Predispositions in the Age of Polarization and The Social Dimension of Political Values, and then listen in next time.